Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. This show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. And it's also my hope that you'll see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, tonight I have a special guest by the name of Linda Case. She's the former president and owner of Case Accounting and Tax Service. She was featured in a Salute to Women in Business published by the Columbus Dispatch newspaper. She's a graduate of Ohio State University and life member of the Ohio State Alumni Association. While attending Ohio State, Linda was featured in the school newspaper promoting the benefits of education. She's a member of the Atlanta Writers Club and continues to promote her career as a writer by participating in creative writing programs. She's a past treasurer for the Public Accountants Society of Ohio, a past member of the International Toastmistress Club, and has experience presenting seminars and workshops. She was born in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, and you can contact Linda through her email, which is linda.loophole@gmail.com. And so Linda has an amazing story to share with you tonight. She's written a marvelous book called The Fugitive Sister. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce her. Linda, once again, how are you tonight?
I'm terrific. How are you, David?
I'm great. I'm looking forward to hearing you tell your story again. It's a powerful story, a story of betrayal and justice gone awry, as far as I'm concerned. I wondered if you would like to kind of set the scenario for what happened to you after, or tell the story of what happened to your sister and how she became one of America's most wanted fugitives, and then what happened when she came to you for help.
Well, I'd like to start out, David. I'd like to ask you a question. Do you have any brothers or sisters?
I had one sister, and she's deceased.
Okay. And I'd like to ask the listeners, if there's any out there, if they have brothers or sisters, to just kind of keep that in the back of their mind when they hear my story. But my sister, Becky, was convicted of multiple white-collar crimes and was looking at up to 75 years in prison, convicted by a jury, and she was allowed to get on an airplane unaccompanied by any law enforcement whatsoever to go from Ohio to Arizona, where her home was, to get on house arrest. And they put, they convicted, I think it was about 10 of them altogether, and They put them on house arrest right away there in Columbus, Ohio. But they let Becky get on a plane unaccompanied and go to Arizona to report and get on house arrest several days later in Arizona. Well, she escaped and disappeared and became one of America's most wanted fugitives. And then she contacted me for help. And that's where my story begins. And it actually begins 8 years earlier. But that's what started the whole story, my story, because she contacted me for help, and she wanted me to help her prove her innocence. And she had written a manuscript that she said would prove her innocence, and it sounded reasonable to me. And I was the only person, she said, and I knew it too, that in the world that could possibly help her, because, you know, you're really sticking your neck out there to help a fugitive. It's not against the law to communicate with a fugitive, but Anyway, I tried to help her. And the way I was trying to help her was she had written a manuscript that proved, she said, proved her innocence. And she wanted me to get it printed and get it into the hands of the Ohio Republican Party boss in Ohio, who was a friend of hers. He was a very good friend of hers. And he was also a very good friend of George W. Bush. Now, we're talking, she disappeared in March of 2008 after the trial. And George W. Bush was about to leave office the following January. And as you know, they, the presidents always, when they leave office, they pardon a slate of criminals. So she was hoping to get this manuscript that proved her innocence into the hands of the Republican Party boss, Robert Bennett. He's now deceased. But into his hands, and ask him to get it into the hands of George W. Bush and hopefully get her a pardon. And so that's what I tried to do to help her. And a lot of things happened in the meantime, but are you there?
I'm here. I'm listening.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I just had a beep on my phone.
Okay.
Yeah, so where was I here? Oh, so that's what I was trying to do. And there's a lot of things that happened in the meantime, but at age 66, with no prior criminal record of any kind, a SWAT team hauled me off to jail like a bag of common garbage. They arrested me and put me in jail. And it's a long, long story here, but that's what happened. But it actually started, my story starts back in 2002. And Becky was convicted in 2008. So, but it started back in 2002 when my brother died in Columbus, Ohio. He lived, Columbus was kind of home for most of my life. My family moved out there when I was a teenager, and Columbus, Ohio, from Point Pleasant, West Virginia, and we kind of grew up there, and I had my business there for years, Case County and Tax Service. And my brother lived there, and my mother lived there, and my brother passed away in 2002. And a few years prior to that, we lost a lot of our men in the family. My dad died, and 9 months later, my stepdad died. And almost 9 months to the date, my son died. And then a few years later, my brother died. My brother died of leukemia at age 62. And so I was living in Buford, Georgia, where I am now, near my two daughters that lived here. Moved here after my son died out in California. And so I went up to Ohio for the funeral, and 2 days after we buried my brother, the FBI raided and shut down my sister's company, which the home office was located in Columbus, Ohio. They had offices in 5 different states, and huge company, you know, multi-million dollars. And so 2 days later after my brother died, they raided and shut down her company. So this is when it all started. And, of course, my mother losing my brother, my oldest and only brother, and Becky was my, you know, the youngest. There was just the three of us. And I used to kid and say I was the abused middle child, but I wasn't really abused, but anyway, I was the middle child. And so Becky's picture was all over the newspapers and TV, and it was almost a $3 billion fraud, and that the company had been accused of money laundering and wire fraud and all sorts of things. In fact, I called Becky the female Bernie Madoff, because I don't know if you've seen the TV series Bernie Madoff, but there's also a movie coming out with Robert De Niro and Michelle Pfeiffer about Bernie Madoff. But Bernie Madoff's fraud was the largest in U.S. history of a public sector fraud, and my sister's was company's was the largest in U.S. history of a private sector fraud. So, it's kind of trendy right now with the Bernie Madoff fraud and a lot of other things are trending right now. You know, the fugitives, the mother and son that became fugitives in Mexico recently, and the movie about that Johnny Depp is in. I think it's called, Black Mass. It's about a fugitive who was one of America's most wanted fugitives. Anyway, I'm kind of getting off track here. But where was I here?
You were talking about the extent of the fraud and about your sister's arrest.
Well, it was almost a $3 billion fraud. There was almost 300 small hospitals and nursing homes and private medical practices all over the country that went bankrupt because of their wrongdoing. And all those employees lost their retirement, lost their jobs. And a lot of investment companies lost millions of dollars. PIMCO, I think it's the world's largest bond fund, lost millions of dollars. Credit Suisse AG lost millions of dollars they had invested in the company. And a lot of policemen and firemen, people lost their retirements because of their wrongdoing. And state of Arizona invested, lost a million or more. And anyway, it was a pretty big deal. And but that happened in 2002 when they raided and shut the company down. But Becky was not indicted until 2006. So for 4 years there, she was allowed to leave the country. She went to Costa Rica. She got married and went on her honeymoon to Costa Rica. She went to Nicaragua with, she joined church after this happened, and out in Arizona. And she went to Nicaragua with a church group, and so she wasn't indicted until 2006. Well,
okay.
After my brother died, I stayed a couple weeks with my mom, and then I came back down here to Beaufort, Georgia, where I lived, and I went back up for my mom's 80th birthday, and I just couldn't believe how she had deteriorated. The mom was old-fashioned. She, she cared about what other people thought, and she had always bragged about Becky and, you know, how wealthy she was and everything. And, of course, you know, for all of those years, it was on the news and the TV, and you know, mom's health just really deteriorated. And so after her birthday, I went up for her birthday. I cried all the way back home, driving 600 miles, and told my daughters that I was going to have to move up there and take care of mom until after the trial, and get her situated and everything. And another thing is Becky was convicted. My brother and I never worried about our mother because Becky was always going to take care of her. Everybody knew that, the family. Everybody knew that Becky was a multimillionaire, and she you know, let everybody know she was going to take care of mom when she got old. And so because of that, my mother signed over after my stepdad died. My mother signed her house over to Becky. She gave her all of her money. So because she knew that Becky was going to take care of her, so she gave all that to Becky. And, of course, I knew if Becky was convicted, you know, they would take mom's house. So anyway, I moved up there to take care of mom. And one of my daughters, Sherry, and her husband moved up there too, because we had been planning to move back to California where my where I had lived when my son died, and I had four grandchildren out there, and we were planning to move back out there, but I said, I've got to move up there and take care of Mom until the trial and, get her situated. Well, the trial didn't start until 2008, February of 2008. And as I said before, she and all the others were convicted, and she was looking at up to 75 years in prison for all of the, wrongdoing. And so convicted by a jury, allowed to get on a plane, and unaccompanied, and away she went, became one of America's most wanted fugitives. And that was in 2008. And then she contacted me for help. And then there's a lot more story after that. So that's the beginning anyway, David. So maybe I can pause for a moment. Maybe you can have some questions or something. But then, I go to jail, and there's a lot more to the story. So.
Well, what were you charged with, Linda?
Well, I can see where the U.S. Marshals thought what they thought, but because they thought, first of all, an attorney, friend of Becky's that she went to school with, she told me to go see him and about her getting her manuscript printed, and I did, and I went to see him and gave him a copy of her manuscript, and she said he could be trusted, and he would take care of the ISBN numbers and all that sort of thing that we would need to get, her book printed or her thing printed, and eventually. Anyway, so I did. I met with him, and turns out he had talked to her after she disappeared and hadn't told anyone, but I told him how we were communicating. Becky had told me this kind of secret way to communicate by email, and that's how she went. We went back and forth with her manuscript until I printed it out. And anyway, I consulted him about getting it printed and the legal aspects of it and everything. And it turns out, he and Becky had been more than friends in the past. They were high school sweethearts and things. And anyway, he asked me how we were communicating, and he started communicating with her too. And eventually, the marshals went to see him, and U.S. marshals, and he lied to them too. And after they left and everything, I guess he thought about it, and in order to save himself, he turned me in. He violated our attorney-client privilege, which I said up front. That's why I went to see him, because Becky said he could be trusted. And anyway, he violated our attorney-client privilege and turned me in. But I've still got to back up here. They charged me, initially with a lot of things, but once they had me in jail and they found out what I was doing and that I knew nothing. I hadn't spoken to Becky in four or five years prior to my brother's death. We just didn't get along that well, and she did something after my son passed away, and I hadn't spoken to her in over 4 years, so, we didn't really get along that great or anything, but I was still going to try and help her prove her innocence.
Mm-hmm. Did you believe she was?
Anyway, I'm sorry.
No, I just wondered. After you looked at her manuscript, did you believe she was innocent then?
There was some doubt there.
Mm-hmm.
There was some doubt that she could possibly. The jury convicted them all across the board. I don't think they understood half of what was going on. I didn't go to any of the trial or anything, but from what I heard and read in the newspapers. This is my opinion and the way I feel about it, and I know Becky pretty well. Lance Payson, there was three CEOs, and Becky was one of them, but Becky's job was the office and the software and things like that. Lance Payson was the one who handled all the investment side of the business, And you never questioned his, you know, whatever he did. I remember Becky telling me this. You never questioned his, anything he did. So I don't think Becky did any of the money laundering things. That was his job. But I think she knew what was going on, and she just, you know, enjoyed the high life and the money and, you know, the greed that goes along with it. And she didn't say anything. I think she knew. I think she knew what he was doing and said nothing. So that's just my opinion. But anyway, when they found out that I didn't really know anything and it was what I was trying to help her do, and I never knew where she was or anything, they charged me with one count of false statements, one lie. And for that, you know, they kept me in jail. They denied bail. Even murderers, you know, sometimes get out on bail. Well, suspected murderers get out on bail. He denied me. Well, first of all, I got the same judge that let Becky get away. And he was very, very embarrassed. He was very, very embarrassed. And my daughter found this attorney, not the one that turned me in, another attorney to represent me. She found him in the Yellow Pages. And it turns out that he at one time was one of my sister's attorneys, and she had fired him. And anyway, this story is so intertwined. I won't be able to tell it all to you in an hour, but the judge would not recuse himself from being my judge. And, you know, I knew when that happened, I asked my attorney, I said, you know, why should I have the same judge who let her get away? You know, he was very vindictive towards me. He even called me by Becky's name a few times. But he wouldn't recuse himself, and they put me in jail and just kind of threw away the key, just used me as jail bait, thinking that Becky would give herself up, but they didn't know Becky. Becky would never do that for me. You know, she contacted me for help because, you know, it wouldn't matter to her if I did get in trouble, you know, whereas, you know, some of her best friends or whatever, she wouldn't put them in jeopardy like that. Anyway, yeah, they charged me with one count of false statements, one lie, and 6 months later, 6 months, 2 days, 1 hour, and 5 minutes later, when the judge, he gave me 6 months of prison sentence, 8 months of house arrest, and 3 years of probation for one lie. He gave me more than was recommended by the, you know, there was a probation officer that recommends a certain sentence, and he gave me more. He was just very vindictive towards me.
He threw the book at you.
He did. And
yeah.
And I survived, though, David. I survived.
How did you weather that? What kept your spirits going?
How did I weather that? Well, a lot of things. Mainly my daughter, Sherry. We spoke almost every day that I was in jail, and she's a very positive spiritual person, and so am I. And she kept me focused, and I had I made a list of the things I was grateful for. And at age 66, I was kind of like the grandma in the dorm. You know, there was 24 girls, and young girls, and having two daughters of my own, I had a lot of conversations with them. Some of them wrote poems for me, and there was a Bible study class in once a week in jail, and wasn't really Bible study. It was more, you know, group discussion and things, but the Bible study teacher told me later that I had made a big impact on the girls and had helped them in many ways that I had no idea. But just talking to them and listening to them and quoting my favorite William Wordsworth little mantra, well, it's from his Ode to Immortality. It's called it's Splendor in the Grass. Would you like me to recite it for you?
Sure.
So nothing can bring back the hour of splendor in the grass, glory in the flower. We will grieve not, rather find strength in what remains behind. And now I'm getting emotional. I recited that a lot and talked to the girls a lot. And I was kind of like the grandma of the group because most of them were in their teens and, excuse me. And early 20s, and they were, you know, mostly on drugs and had little kids. And I just talked to them. And then the few that were in their 30s and 40s was usually DUIs, things like that. But I was probably the oldest that had been in there in a while. And there was only one. I tried to make something good come out of it, but it was hard. I put it right up there with, you know, the death of my son, the anxiety. You are absolutely helpless, and it's just hopeless. You have no say over anything. They treat you as if you are, you know, a criminal, even if you're not. It's hard. It was very hard. But
what would you describe as the predominant feeling? I'm sure there was a barrage of feelings connected to this. Was grief the largest of them?
Well, grief is real, yes, grief. Grief and is real, but everyone has grief, especially these days. There's so much grief out there, you know, with the war, losing people in the war, losing people with weather, these weird weather things that are happening, the school shootings. I mean, everybody has trauma in their life and grief in their life. And there's an old saying, it's 10% what happens and 90% of how you react to it. I told people, you know, in there and my stories or parts of it, and nobody could believe it happened to me. And, you know, it was on the news. We had a small TV. And nobody could believe it. And I started writing things down that I remembered and happening. And I put my grief into words. But what really helped me, yeah, grief is the main thing. Grief. I mean, you just, you are so helpless. And you just have no say over anything. You lose your freedom. And we do not appreciate our freedom like we should until we lose it. And I'm telling you, I'm grateful every day. I still have my grateful prayer. Every day I'm so grateful. I lost my house to foreclosure. I lost my retirement and savings to attorney fees, material things. I am so grateful for my freedom. When I first got out of jail, I just sat in a rocking chair on the back porch and just breathed and, you know, looked, watched the squirrels and the flowers and just was so happy to be alive and free. Oh, my God. You just have no idea what it's like to lose your freedom. And I'm so thankful for it every day. I have another little thing. I have a lot of little mantras that I told the girls in jail, and I tell myself all the time still. let's see, there's one about dancing in the rain. I can't remember it at the moment, but there's one I sing around the house all the time. Always look on the bright side of your life.
That's a good mantra.
That's
a great mantra. Sounds like gratitude is what saved you, but I'm wondering what kinds of feelings were stirred up within you regarding your sister, and how did you deal with those?
You know, I don't blame my sister at all. Mm-hmm. I feel sorry for my sister. She had a good life, you know, and something happens. They get so greedy. I don't blame my sister. It would have been great had she not contacted me. That would have been great. But she did. But, she was in another country. She didn't force me to do anything. I feel sorry for her, but she has always been able to manipulate me. And I say this in the book. She was the baby. And she used to be, an ornery little kid. And she was my baby, doll baby for a while until she got to a certain age, and when they become nasty and mischievous. And she would be so mischievous that every night she'd be afraid to go to sleep. And Mom would make Danny, my brother and I, forgive her for all the mean things she had done to us all day. We'd have to forgive her every night before she could go to sleep. Mom would make us forgive her. So I think Becky grew up thinking that, she could do whatever and ask for forgiveness and everything would be fine. I don't blame Becky. I do not blame anyone but myself. She has a way of manipulating me and using me, which I guess goes from, growing up as a big sister. But even the judge said that when he sentenced her after she was captured. He said, the worst thing that you did was manipulate and use your sister. And if you say you're sorry to anyone, you should say you're sorry to your sister. The judge said that even so. She can manipulate me, and my daughters though have said, they'll put me away if I have any contact with Becky, because she's just not appropriate in my life. She's just she uses me, she's able to manipulate and use me, and I just, they won't let that happen to me anymore. So I'm 72 now, going on 40, but I'm planning to be around a long time. But, I can't have contact with that. But I don't blame Becky. I don't blame anyone but myself.
That's really amazing. I would think that you would have feelings of resentment or betrayal connected to her.
No, I don't. I don't at all.
Really?
I didn't have to do
so anything. Has forgiveness been your pathway to freedom from those kinds of feelings toward her?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
When you forgive someone, that doesn't mean that you forget what they did or, agree with what they've done, but you can forgive. You can forgive them, which I have. I have. If you can't forgive people and go on, you're in deep doo-doo.
Yes. Well, I think it's remarkable that you were able to own your part without blaming her. That is such a mature thing, and a lot of people get caught up in the blame trap, and I don't hear that that's happened to you at all.
Not at all. No, not at all. I would like to have my independence back. I'm living with my daughter right now, my other daughter, Trisha, and they've been wonderful. I have two wonderful daughters, and I'm so grateful for that. But I'd like to have my independence back. As I said, I'm 72 going on 40. But other than that, you know, I'm not into material things or anything like that. I'm so grateful to be alive every day. And I always did smell the flowers, but now I really, really smell the flowers. And we have squirrels in the back here, and we're, you know, up against the woods. And I'm just so grateful for every single day of my life. And I want to say something, too, before I forget it, about grief. And when I first got out of jail, I just couldn't think about it or talk about it. I just wanted to breathe and be grateful and enjoy my freedom. But then, you know, I'm so emotional. I was an emotional wreck emotionally, and cried all the time, still do. But I started seeing a counselor, a therapist, compliments of the federal government, and while I was on probation, and plus, you know, I was there by myself in Ohio, in Columbus. I had my Aunt Clara was real close to me, and but that was the only person that I had. My mom was in the Alzheimer's Care Center there by then. She was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2006, and anyway, yeah, well, I was on house arrest for 8 months and 3 years of probation. Then I started seeing a therapist, and she was fantastic. She said, Linda, she said, you need to get this grief out. You need to get it out of your body. Talk about it. So, you know, I was telling her my story and that I'd been writing some things down, and because, you know, it was just so unusual and intertwined. And I'm an avid reader, but I've never read anything like my story. And she said, well, why don't you write, you know, a chapter or two a week and bring it to the session and let's talk about it. So I did, and we talked about it. I cried the whole hour. And by the end of my sessions with her, which was a couple years later, she was crying too. It's quite a story.
So that's how the book evolved.
It did. I'm a firm believer, and I hope that my story will inspire and encourage other people to put their grief into words and write about it. And it'll help other people, you know, to get through their grief, hopefully. Hopefully my story will help other people. Here's one thing, too. There's a lot of lessons in the book. Actions have consequences. I thought, you know, I was doing a good thing. You know, I had no clue in my head that I could ever go to prison, get a prison sentence for what I was trying to do. My actions were good. My intentions were good. Excuse me. My intentions were good. I intended, you know, good, but my actions were not. You know, I did eventually lie to the U.S. Marshals, because when they asked me if I had heard from her, I was right in the middle of trying to get this thing printed and into the hands of George W. Bush before he left office. So I said no. So actions have consequences. And even though, you know, you've got to stop and think when you make choices, you just, you know, you've got to realize, you know, you have consequences. Now, I never heard the Miranda rights. I never knew what that was. I never heard the term. And people said, well, you've seen it on TV. You're right. You have the right to be silent, blah, blah, blah. I had heard that. But nobody ever said that to me when they arrested me and stuff. They never said, you have the right to be silent. And when they came to my house, I invited them in and talked to them without an attorney. And, you know, I did not have to let them in my house when they came to my house, which was about a year after Becky had been gone, was when they came to my house, and also that's when they went to see the attorney that turned me in. Was like a year after the trial. So I had no clue that could happen to me. when I was talking to them. You know, just one little lie when I was trying to do something so big and help her prove her innocence. And but yet, you know, thou shalt not lie. Not at all. And it's,
well,
it's weird because
lesson learned the hard way, eh?
I did. I learned a big lesson. So
take a little break, and we do have a caller that's been on the line for quite a while.
Okay.
Why don't we see what, if anything, they would like to say to you, and then we can talk some more about actions, consequences, and your book, and your hopes for your book. How does that sound?
That sounds great.
All right. Let me go to the caller. Okay. Area code 224, you're live on the air. What is your name, please? Hello, can you hear me? Area code 224. Would you like to speak with Linda Case? Okay, well, I don't know what the problem was. It sounded like there was some sound going on in the background, but we'll try again in a little while, area code 224. So you're talking about consequences, and I think that's a very important subject with regard to any decision or action that we make in our life, because there is a law of cause and effect that goes on in the universe, and you know, you realized it at a very visceral level, but you know, there are also our spiritual consequences to our actions too, and it sounds like you have been through hopefully you've been through a self-forgiveness process as well. Where do you stand with that?
Oh yes, I'm fine with myself. I've forgiven myself. I'm happy, I'm positive, I'm spiritual, I'm grateful, very, very grateful every day for every single thing that I have. And I believe that the universe gives back, for you know, what you give out. And I think everything happens for a reason, and I believe that with all my heart. And there was a reason that happened to me. And,
what would you say the greatest lesson has been that's come out of this for you, Linda?
The greatest lesson?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the greatest lesson is thinking before I make choices. You know, we have choices all the time in our lives.
Yeah.
And I've made some really bad choices in my life, but none quite that magnitude. But and the universe has a way, I think, of teaching us lessons. If we make a bad choice, you know, it comes back and slaps us upside the head again and again and again until we get it right. And I think making good choices and being grateful for everything in my life and appreciating my freedom every single day of my life, not taking it for granted.
That's a beautiful lesson. Love us.
There's so much grief and trauma and adversity in the world. And you just have to look at the good. There is good, too. There's a lot of good in the world. And I don't dwell on the bad things. I don't watch the news. I watch the weather. But I like movies. That's about the extent of my TV. I love movies. That's my entertainment now. Movies. I love good movies.
Speaking of movies, you said that you hoped your book would be made into a movie and a TV series. Would you like to talk a little bit about that? And just to let you know, that caller keeps calling back, so if they call in again, I'll try again. There might have been a technical problem. But let's talk about your hopes and your dreams for your book. And the book we're talking about tonight is The Fugitive Sister by Linda L. Case, which is the story that she's been telling.
Well, I was just going to talk about the TV series. Those of the audience listening that are old enough that would remember the TV series that came out with David Janssen called The Fugitive in the 1960s was so popular that there is a loyal fan club out in California that meets once a year every year. They have met for 50-some years now to pay tribute once a year to Richard Kimball, the doctor in the TV series. And it was not based on a book, but the book came out later. But then the movie came out in 1993 with Harrison Ford, and it's on my cable TV channel right now. It's on all the time. It's so popular. So I'm hoping that The Fugitive Sister will garner some of that publicity. You know, I don't expect a lot. I really would like to have my life back, but I think there's a lot of good lessons and inspiration in my story that might help other people handle their grief, no matter what it is, you know, what kind of grief. Grief is grief. Grief is hard. Grief is real. That might help them get through their grief and survive. Survive and be a better person for it. And that's what I'm hoping. It will become a movie and or, you know, maybe a Netflix TV series or a Lifetime, something. But I think the name alone, you know, might garner some of that publicity. And I of course, I'm prejudiced, but I think it's worthy of it. But that's not really, you know, it helped get me through that emotional 8 months of house arrest and 3 years of probation out of my life. You know, at my age, that's a lot of life. And I learned a lot from writing the book and from experiencing what I did. And I'd like to tell my story to people, and I'd like to be able to help them through their grief. And I think my story does that. And and the freedom part. Freedom is huge. And I'm not paranoid, but I put my seatbelt on. I don't go over the speed limit. There's no way I ever want to encounter anything like that again. Oh, I wanted to show you or tell you a comparison here about my sentence. My Becky's husband, Gary, was also communicating with Becky, and he lied to the marshals, and he knew where she was. He was sending her money and clothing and things like that. And you know what his sentence was?
No.
4 months of house arrest. That's what he got.
Wow.
Compared to my sentence.
Mm.
So, yeah, and I also wanted to mention that my story has been written. There's been some huge articles in some major newspapers. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Personal Journeys, published a huge article about the fugitive. It's titled "The Fugitive" in their Personal Journeys section of their paper, and newspaper out in California, San Ynez Valley News. That's where I used to live out there. They they published a big article, the Columbus Dispatch, where this took place, and my hometown of Point Pleasant. It's been in the newspapers. It's a story that needs to be told, and that will help people, I think, with all the grief right now, with the trauma and things going on in the world. But
Well, we can learn a lot from the example of others, and just aside from the practical issues involved in your situation, I think that people can be inspired by stories of how the spirit has risen above the situation and how people have prevailed and endured a situation like you did. You mentioned some lessons that were learned from writing the book. What were some of those?
From writing? You mean the actual writing?
Yes. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought you said that there were lessons learned from actually having written the book, as well as the lessons learned from your experience.
Well, I learned a lot of things from living that, 3 years of probation, so that that was started in 2002, so it's been 15 years. I've learned so much, and I think I'm a better person for it, and I'm quieter. I'm quieter. I was always not very active person before, but I'm quieter than I used to be, and I don't know. There was a lot of lessons, David. As I said before, making choices, not telling even a little lie, just thinking about your choices. And I wanted to say this, too, that I forgot to say. The hardest thing for me to... The hardest thing for me to, what's the word I want? The hardest thing for me to accept is the fact that my sister did not make any provisions for our mother. So my mother had nothing. Once Becky was convicted, the government takes all, takes everything that Becky had that they could find, of course. But they took my mother's house, that belonged to the government. They were going to take it, because it was in Becky's name. So my mother lost everything. She had nothing. She didn't have any life insurance or anything. And Becky did not set up anything for my mother. Now, here's a lesson, too. Not a lesson, but if you were convicted by a jury looking at up to 75 years in prison, and your mother's house was in your name, but you were still a multimillionaire before they hadn't taken anything, in the beginning there, wouldn't you set up something just in case you went to prison? Wouldn't you set up something for your mother? Since she didn't, since she had given everything to Becky, she didn't set up anything for my mother. Nothing. Mm. My mother is still living. She is here with me, close by me here in Buford. She'll be 92 in May, but she has end-stage Alzheimer's. And it's been really hard because I didn't have anything left money-wise or house or anything, because they took all my stuff. My daughters have helped with my mom. But that's been the hardest thing for me to understand and accept, is that Becky did not provide for our mother. Hello? What is that? Who does that?
Yeah. It's very short-sighted, is a kind way of putting it. What has become of Becky?
Well, you're going to have to read the book, David.
That I will do.
No.
And we don't want to spoil the story for people that want to read the book. Touche, Linda.
I was kidding. Becky is in federal prison, serving a 25-year sentence in California. She's in federal prison. That's where she is. I was just kidding. But there is a lot more of the story. You know, 6 months of prison is in there, and, a lot more. It covers, the entire period from when my brother died until, I won't tell you the end of it, but through the prison sentence and everything. So,
well, let me just ask you a question, because we are coming up on the close of the hour. Did you ever think that when you were writing chapter by chapter for your therapist and for your own personal therapy that you would be publishing this book?
I didn't think that initially, no, not at all. I was just writing it because it was, I was putting my grief into words, and it was therapeutic. It really was helpful to put it down.
And how did you decide to seek out an agent?
How did I decide that? Well, by the end of the story, it was hundreds of pages.
Yeah.
I thought it could inspire and encourage other people. And that, if it was a book and got out there, that I could speak and I could help others going through grief of any kind.
Yes.
Because it has,
it's all about, isn't it? We're here to help each other. Yeah.
Yes, we are.
Yeah.
And I love telling my story and talking about it. And I'm getting better. You know, I'm not so emotional anymore, and I hope to get better with time. But certain parts of it I still can't talk about without crying. And I'm good. I'm happy. I'm grateful. I'm in a very good place, and I would like to help others get to that place, because there's so much grief out there right now.
Do you have any final words that you'd like to share?
Well, I have a website if anybody's interested.
Okay.
There's a lot of information out there, and it's just called the Fugitive Sister, fugitives plural, no apostrophe or anything, thefugitivesister.com, and there's a whole lot of information out there, and my email, you've given them my email address. I'd love to hear from anybody. I would love to. I'll write you back, I promise. I'd love to share my story and hopefully help some others with grief of any kind. There's lots of it out there.
Well, thank you, Linda. You did a great job today. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your story with us.
Well, thank you, David. Anytime. Just love talking to you, too.
Well, good night and God bless. And so now we can come to a close. Let's pause and reflect upon the idea that we're all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who can and will have a spiritual experience if we let it be. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize. Good night, Linda.
Good night, David, and thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. God bless.